The new Wegovy pill is now available through Weight Watchers. Powerful GLP-1 results in a simple pill at the lowest price available. And with Weight Watchers, you can get doctor support and personalized nutrition programs. See if you qualify at weightwatchers.com. Ad not reviewed or approved by Novo Nordisk.
Hello, American Prestige listeners. It's Derek, and I am pleased to welcome back to the program, maybe not under the circumstances, but just to have her here, Maryam Jemshidi. She is Associate Professor of Law at the University of Colorado Law School. She specializes in international law, foreign policy law, national security law. She's been on the program before. She is our NatSec legal desk, I suppose, on American Prestige. So, Maryam, thank you so much for coming back on the program.
Thank you for having me, albeit under these unfortunate circumstances. I'm still glad to be here, though.
Yes, and I want to talk about the unfortunate circumstances. But before we do that, let's discuss the strictly legal aspects or illegal aspects, as the case may be, of the U.S.-Israeli war on Iran. And just to kind of lay the groundwork here, can you explain to me what legal case these people have made for this war? Because it is, and we can talk about the extent to which they've just kind of fumbled their homework or not done any work at all. But they have at least made motions in the direction of a legal argument here. And I'm baffled by it because it changes from person to person. And it's, like they've gone through a bunch of different iterations of it. But as you've been able to parse what the administration is saying, why are they arguing that this was a justified military action?
I mean, these arguments are all over the place, and they are clearly an afterthought. As you mentioned, people are contradicting one another in terms of the arguments that they're presenting and trying to justify this as a legal matter. I mean, it seems like there are a couple of different arguments, as far as I can tell, maybe three broad arguments. The first is that Iran was about to attack Israel, or alternative, Israel was about to attack Iran, and that Iran, in response, was going to attack both Israel and the United States. So the United States needed to preempt that. The other version, as far as I could tell, is that Iran was about to attack the United States, and so the United States needed to preempt that. And then the other one, which I think has been the most consistent, is that this was necessary in order to prevent Iran from developing a nuclear weapon, which, Donald Trump had claimed to obliterate Iran's nuclear program in June, and its own intelligence agency said that Iran was not developing a nuclear weapon, but nevertheless, this was necessary in order to prevent Iran from developing its nuclear weapon. And as part of that, it was necessary to strike at Iran's ballistic missile capabilities and drone capabilities because Iran was going to use those as cover to create a nuclear weapon and prevent anyone from doing anything about it. So as you can tell from all of these descriptions, these are all very complicated, hard to believe arguments that the administration has tried to piece together to justify this. I mean, on the Israel is going to strike Iran, and
right,
then
we needed
Iran
to preempt
is going to
the
start,
retaliation
you know?
To right. an unprovoked attack by somebody right. else.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. I mean,
that's a bit much.
There are many levels of speculation behind that, problematically start with Israel launching an illegal and unjustified war against the United States. Again, the notion that Iran was going to attack the U.S. separate and apart from that, they provide no evidence for any of this, right, fundamentally. And the thing that really makes it all hilarious and ridiculous and impossible to believe is that for weeks, Trump was threatening to attack Iran if Iran did not agree to a deal on the United States' terms. You know, basically, unless Iran capitulated to what the United States wanted from Iran, which included no enrichment at all of uranium, which Iran is entitled to do under the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. They can enrich their uranium. They just can't create a weapon. The other one was that they would basically dismantle or significantly restrict their ballistic missile program. Again, this is Iran's basically only defensive capability that the United States wanted it to give up. And then finally, that it end all support for its regional allies, resistance groups that are trying to prevent Israel from either occupying their land, as in Lebanon, or trying to resist ongoing occupation and colonization in Palestine. These were the things that the United States expected Iran to agree to completely, you know? And if Iran didn't agree to this, Donald Trump made very clear he was going to attack. And he, to prove that he was serious, he deployed massive amounts of military assets to the region. The United States already has massive amounts of military assets in the region. It has many, many military bases. But on top of that, he sent destroyers, all sorts of airplanes, all sorts of other assets to the region over the course of several weeks.
Two aircraft carrier groups. I mean, really.
Two aircraft carrier groups to position the United States.
I think there's a third one heading there now. Like,
that's what I've heard as well.
Great deal of force.
To position the United States in a way that its threats would be meaningful, you know? So to now then say that the United States somehow had the right to self-defense after threatening Iran, which is itself a violation of the U.S. Charter, with force, backing that up with the deployment of so many troops and assets to the region is, you know, laughable. So that's certainly not going to be a basis. Oh, Iran might have struck us, because frankly, Iran would have probably had a right to preemptively attack the United States and Israel, especially the United States, given those threats. And then the nuclear argument is similarly laughable for reasons that I mentioned. A, the United States' own claim that Iran's nuclear enrichment capacity had been destroyed in June, and multiple pieces of evidence, including from U.S. intelligence, that Iran wasn't enriching uranium, and there, in connection with that, was not in the process of developing any kind of nuclear weapon. So there is no plausible legal justification of any kind for what the United States and Israel did to Iran starting on February 28th.
The demand that Iran basically cap its ballistic missile for, like, that one to me sticks out, because you can, yeah, I mean, under the NPT, if you have a suspicion that Iran is developing a nuclear weapon, which, again, there wasn't one, but if you have one, that's a legitimate concern. But, I mean, there's nothing about not having missiles that can go over, 1,500 kilometers or whatever the cap was. And basically, just like the limit being, you can't have any missiles that can reach Israel. So the Israeli military can bomb Iran with impunity without any fear of retaliation. Like, there's just no justification for that, right? Like, there's no exception to the law of self-defense that says Iran is not entitled to defend itself.
Right. I mean, none of those. There are only two grounds legally that, you can go to war. You know, one is because you have the right of self-defense, because you've been attacked unlawfully, or where the Security Council, under its Chapter 7 powers, green lights a use of force. We clearly don't have a Chapter 7 authorization here. And as I mentioned, the United States and Israel have no plausible argument on self-defense. And this notion that the nuclear weapons issue somehow created a plausible right to self-defense for either Israel or the United States is crazy. The right to self-defense is the right to respond to ongoing attack or imminent attacks at most. It's not about forecasting into the future, God knows how far into the future, that maybe one day, maybe the state might do something that constitutes an armed aggression against you. That is not the standard, you know? That is what the standard that maybe the United States and Israel want us to believe is the standard, but it certainly isn't. And again, there's also no evidence that Iran wanted before this war, things have probably changed now, wanted to even develop a nuclear weapon, you know? So there's just so many pieces of this ridiculous, you know, scenario they've put out there that just falls apart on even like the tiniest bit of scrutiny, you know, and the ballistic missile stuff, you know, like this negotiating position that like you need to now give up your ballistic missile capability is not new. You know, Israel has been pushing it for a while, but, you know, to imagine that a country like Iran that was just attacked, you know, quite brutally and again illegally by Israel and the United States in June in the midst of nuclear negotiations would somehow agree, you know, to give up the only assets it has, you know, that protect it in any way from its very aggressive neighbor Israel and its close ally the United States, you know, was crazy. And I don't even think the United States, you know, the only way the United States thought it could get that was by threatening force and now by launching war, which, you know, should demonstrate how ridiculous from a political standpoint that demand was.
Right. Disarm yourself or we're going to attack you.
Or we're going to, exactly. Pretty, yeah. Of course. Who wouldn't say ridiculous. Yes to that? Yeah. Right.
What you're describing has echoes to me of the lead up to the Iraq War in the sense that this argument about some nebulous threat in the future that we can't really define for you, we don't know when it might be actualized, but it's out there and we have to be worried about it, was the mm-hmm. same argument that we were making about Iraq's, you know, alleged nuclear weapons program. And it crosses from preemptive war, which you can make an argument in some situations is legitimate, like if Iran had preemptively attacked the two U.S. aircraft carrier groups that were preparing to attack it. But it crosses from that into like preventative war, which, you know, there really is no basis for mm-hmm. launching a preventative war. But I guess this is leading into my question, which is, in the case of the Iraq War, to make that argument, we got months of browbeating from the Bush administration about mm-hmm. the threat of Saddam Hussein, the dangers, mm-hmm. his ties alleged to Al-Qaeda and his weapons of mass destruction. With this, we got like a week of Donald Trump occasionally popping off. Like the State of the Union address was a couple of days before he launched this war. He barely mentioned Iran at all in the State mm-hmm. of the Union address, mm-hmm. like days away from what he was planning to do. It's just surprising to me how little effort they put into making a justifying argument for this ahead of time. And now it feels in to some degree like they are surprised that they're even being asked the question of legality mm-hmm. or justification. And they're sort mm-hmm. of slapping it together after the fact. Have you taken, like, is that sort of your impression as well? Or what do you make of like the this being treated almost as an afterthought?
Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right. At least like, you know, I mean, as horrifying and illegal as the U.S. invasion and occupation of Iraq was, you know, at least they tried, you know, at least they tried to make the legal case both to the American public as well as to the United Nations, as well as at the Security Council. You know, they did try and get support from the international community for what they wanted to do. The international community saw through it and didn't buy it and was actually far more vociferous and very clear-eyed in its opposition to what the Bush administration is doing than, frankly, I think what we're seeing now, at least from, you know, the Canadians, the Australians, and the Western Europeans. But, like, you know, there was some effort to put together a PR campaign that centered around the legal justification for this. And also, you know, talking just about the domestic scenario, that they got an authorization for the use of military force from Congress for what they did in Iraq. So like, you know, I'm not, again, trying to legitimize anything that happened, but at least an effort was made, both the domestic level and the international level, to try and present what they wanted to do as being within the bounds of the law. Here, I mean, they could care less. I mean, a lot of this feels like an afterthought. In some ways, the attack against Iran feels like an afterthought as well. You know, obviously what happened in June happened, and I think that opened a Pandora's box of possibilities as far as Donald Trump was concerned. You know, he waited to see what Israel was doing, waited to see if it was succeeding. And when he thought it was succeeding, he wanted a piece of that success. And so he dropped the bombs on the Fordo nuclear site, right? And then claimed immediate success. The war was over and the Iranians agreed to it, I think, to their significant regret at this point that they agreed to that ceasefire. And on the wings of that success, you know, coupled with the success in Venezuela, with the ousting and arrest of Maduro and the, you know, now compliant Delcy Rodriguez administration that is effectively, it seems like, doing whatever Trump wanted. I think those two things together, coupled with a very aggressive Benjamin Netanyahu, who, you know, wants to take Iran down in this moment where he feels Iran is at its weakest point, really got Donald Trump on side when it comes to this stuff. And of course, the domestic protests in Iran contributed as well to his sort of egomaniacal fantasy about, you know, saving the Iranian people and ending the Iranian revolution. So it doesn't, I mean, I don't know, I don't have, you know, any insight into U.S. military planning, but it doesn't feel like this was planned for very long. It feels like this was planned maybe for a couple of weeks, maybe for a couple of months, maybe from December, maybe. You know, the Iranians have been planning for this since June. Maybe the Israelis have too, but I don't get the impression the Americans have been planning for it for very long. So in some sense, like, there's no legal justification because I don't really think this has been on, you know, part of the plan for all that long. But at the same right. time, even if it was, this is not an administration, you know, like, I'm sure this will shock many people to hear me say that cares very much about what the law says or whether or not the law is constraining. Certainly Donald from Trump, an international yeah. standpoint, they don't care at all. Their project is to dismantle the international system politically and legally, to basically, you know, make international law, hollow it out completely or eliminate it in all its aspects, you know? So why would they think at all about the international law restrictions on what they do? They have made it very clear that they think international law does nothing other than hold America back from its, you know, inherent birthright of dominating the entire world. So, you know, I'm not so surprised that there's been no legal arguments presented, even if they had been planning this for a while, because like their entire political project is, you know, contrary to the existence of the international legal regime.
Weight Watchers now offers access to affordable GLP-1s.
Weight Watchers has everything I need, from weight loss medications to nutrition support and help with my side effects.
With our program, our members are losing more weight with expert nutrition and side effect support.
Weight Watchers prescribing GLP-1 medications, it's been life-changing.
Better results, expert support, lose more weight, make it last. Get started for as low as $25 at weightwatchers.com.
All medications require eligibility and prescription. First month as low as $25 with a 12-month med plus plan. Does not include the cost of GLP-1 medications.
So I want to ask about one incident in particular, because I think it's indicative of the way a lot of people are talking about this war and the hypocrisy of the way it's being communicated to people. And that's the Israeli strike over the weekend on Tehran. They hit a number of fuel depots kind of on the outskirts mm-hmm. of the city, lighting them on fire, sending toxic gas, smoke into the air that's now been raining down as acid rain for a couple of days that people have been advised to stay inside. There are going to be health impacts. It spewed oil everywhere, set fires that I think may still be burning in a couple of cases. Just, I mean, the videos that I saw were apocalyptic. And the Israeli justification for this from, you know, a at least quasi-legal perspective is that these were IRGC fuel depots. So they're legitimate military target. But surely blowing them up and gassing the city of Tehran with millions of civilians living there cannot possibly be a justifiable act, right? Like, what is the legal, what are the legal considerations there, I guess?
Yeah, so if you're, so this is assuming that though that oil depots, the oil depots were in fact military objectives. I mean, there has been a lot of reporting suggesting that they were not. They were civilian oil depots used, you know, for the benefit of the people living inside Tehran and the suburb of Karaj. But if they were military objectives, then as part of the assessment of whether or not they should be targeted, the Israelis should have assessed proportionality. So the requirement, you know, of proportionality basically is that, like, you know, if you are going to attack a military objective and that attack, its consequences will result in civilian casualties or destruction of civilian objects that is excessive as compared to the military advantage of the strike, then you can't do the strike. So if these were IRGC oil depots, they would have had to assess, okay, what are the consequences going to be, right, for the civilian population in these areas of us engaging in the strike? And I don't know how of depriving the IRGC of this oil, right? Like, that's the objective, right? Now the IRGC doesn't have this oil. Is that objective so valuable that it outweighs the expected civilian harm? I mean, the level of civilian harm that has and will result from this is so immense that it is hard to think of any military advantage that would actually rise to the level of justifying something like this. I mean, you saw the videos. I saw the videos. I spoke to family inside Iran. I mean, the air was unbreathable. It remains unbreathable. There's already pretty bad pollution into for a variety of different reasons. This is just taking it into the stratosphere, not to mention the ways the water is being polluted, the way the land is being polluted, the carcinogens that are now in the air, right? That can cause God knows what kinds of illnesses down the line. You know, people
right.
Have,
I mean, no exaggeration to say, like, this is years. Yeah. We're maybe years
from knowing.
We're
talking about,
like,
years of damage, yeah, right? For the sake of depriving the IRGC of a couple of oil depots. There are other, you know, without a doubt, other oil resources that they can access. You know, this is Iran's largest city. This is its most densely populated city. To target oil depots in this city and on its outskirts is to impact the lives of tens of millions of people in really detrimental ways. It is the definition of a disproportionate attack. Again, assuming this was even a military objective, it seems like it was a civilian objective, which would have made its deliberate strike feel completely unlawful and a war crime. So, you know, it is, you know, but it is one great example, you know, of the modus operandi, both of Israel and of the United States. They are both very well experienced. They have demonstrated their desire and their inclination to attack these kinds of sites in the past as well. This is another reminder that when it comes to the laws of war, when it comes to the law surrounding, you know, military combat, unfortunately, the United States and Israel do little other than violate those terms and try to reset them in ways that make war far more dangerous and far more deadly for civilians.
So my last strictly legal question, and in the interest of fair play, I guess, I do feel like I need to ask you about the Iranian reaction, the decision to target the Gulf states and initially U.S. facilities, military facilities in the Gulf states, which seems pretty straightforward. But then to expand that package beyond the targeting package beyond that.
Yeah.
What can we say in terms of the legitimacy of what the Iranians have been doing here?
Yeah. So, I mean, the military bases, you know, in those countries are, you know, it's lawful to target them you know, if they were involved in, certainly if they were directly involved in the attacks by Israel and Iran. Sorry, did I say Israel and Iran? Israel and the United States against Iran. But arguably, even if they were indirectly involved, so for example, if they were providing intelligence, surveillance, and things like that. Now, you know, beyond the bases, of course, the question is like, you know, what about all those other assets beyond the bases that Iran has allegedly attacked? I mean, some of them, Iran has claimed, and there seems to be some reporting backing it up, that some of those other assets were assets that were housing like military personnel that had been moved from those bases to those civilian structures like hotels, which would, you know, arguably make them targetable. Again, you know, those individuals and their involvement in the attack would be, you know, a relevant piece of information. But broadly speaking, you know, if you target...
Like proportionality would apply there too, right? Like,
I mean, I would say it would. The United States and Israel treat, you know, for example, if there's a apartment building that has like a soldier in it, you know, or an apartment building where, you know, weapons are being held, the U.S. and Israel will treat that entire apartment building as a lawful military objective, and they will not engage in proportionality. But that is arguably an outlier position. And the correct position is that you should still engage in proportionality analysis. So you should, you know, do what I just described with respect to the oil depots, evaluate the military advantage in striking the sort of military asset in the apartment, and evaluate that against the expected civilian losses that will result from the strike. And if it's disproportionate in terms of those losses, then you shouldn't engage in the strike. So, you know, there have been hits against some hotels, again, that some soldiers were apparently in UAE. I believe there were actually like intelligence personnel, like, so they were operating intelligence stations out of some of these hotels. Maybe it was also in commercial spaces. I can't remember, but you know, those would seem to be, you know, Iran would seem to have a credible argument that those were lawful strikes. I mean, we could at least say it's a gray area. It gets harder when we're talking about oil facilities, and you know, the oil facilities are the ones I'm most familiar with. I don't know if they've been hitting, you know, other kinds of civilian structures. Oh, I guess they have been, the airports as well. The airports, the oil facilities, those are the ones that come to mind right now.
Closing the Strait of Hormuz. I know it's just been reported today. They might be mining it like that. Where does that kind of fall in this?
So, I mean, the Strait of Hormuz issue is a little bit more complicated. It's an international waterway. So there are certain rules that govern the international waterways that are different from the rules that govern territorial waterways. But, you know, like if we're thinking about the response on the, you know, territory of these other states, once it starts leaving the realm of, you know, bases and potential civilian structures where military personnel have been moved or military activity is happening, once we move past that, then we get into the space of sort of unlawful strikes. So Iran's hands are not clean here either. I would say, though, that when we're looking at the totality of violations, we're looking at, you know, broadly the legality versus illegality of actions taken by both sides. You know, Israel and the United States started an illegal war. You know, like everything they do is basically unlawful. I mean, the laws of war governing what they actually do during the conduct are separate from the laws governing the actual initiation of the attack. But you can't get away from the fact that that initial illegality can never be remedied, right? They can attack only military objectives inside Iran. Their war is illegal, period, right? Iran has a right to self-defense, and it has a right to attack those bases. And those those are legal. Has it gone beyond that? Probably. On the overall assessment, Israel and the United States have committed far more in terms of illegal acts and war crimes, I think, than Iran has so far.
Right. I mean, I would say like everything flows from that first decision to launch an illegal war. And then to make it feel at least like an existential conflict for the Iranians, under which like international law is not going to be top of mind for anybody in the decision-making process if they feel like this is, you know, the end of the line, if they don't resist in the, you know, harshest way possible. It all flows from the U.S. and Israeli conduct, it seems to me.
Yeah, it does. I mean, you know, those, you know, states certainly, you know, once Iran strikes, start going beyond bases, you know, like if they rise, those strikes rise the level of what we call an armed attack, you know, they have a right to self-defense. It's not a right to self-defense that the United States can exercise on their behalf. But, you know, but those states could act collectively to respond or on their own to respond to what Iran has done. Other states, if they have been so requested, can come to the collective self-defense of those states. But Israel and the United States absolutely cannot because they're the aggressors.
So, Miriam, I want to give you space here. You mentioned speaking to family in Tehran. I know, you know, you're from Iran. You have family there. You've been sharing, I saw on social media, pictures of Tehran under happier circumstances and you know, just sort of trying to talk about the city and your country, that, you know, the country that you know when it's not being attacked by the U.S. and Israel. And so I didn't want to just do a strictly legal discussion here. I wanted to give you some time at the end to sort of share your thoughts and you know, kind of overall impressions, I guess, as this is unfolding.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I don't think that there are any winners in war. I'm sorry to say something so trite, but you know, this has been framed by a lot of Iranians as well as a war that's, you know, going to help the Iranian people liberate themselves from the Islamic Republic. And, you know, it was hard to see that, to see how that would possibly happen before the war was launched. And I think the last 10 days, 11 days have just demonstrated how naive and misguided those views were. You know, the internet has been totally cut off. So it's very hard for people from inside the country to reach out. It's hard for us here to reach family inside. It's hard to even call landlines from outside of Iran. So, you know, we kind of wait for our families to contact us so we can hear about how they're doing. You know, back in June, a lot of people left Tehran. They went to other parts of the country that seemed safer. And, you know, that probably were safer than Tehran was then. As in now, Tehran really bore the brunt of the attacks. But now, at least, like, you know, if you're from anywhere on the western side or the central part of Iran, like, nowhere is safe. You know, I have family in other parts of Iran as well, but they're all on the western and central side of Iran, you know, so there's nowhere to really flee to either. You know, like, if you are in Tehran or if you're in Urmia, if you're in Shiraz or if you're in Isfahan, like, there's not really anywhere else you can or would go to. And some people have left Tehran in particular, but I don't get the impression that lots of people have left in specifically because of this issue of, like, where would you really go? You know, Iran has been under, you know, some of the most extreme sanctions any country has ever experienced for a very, very long time. It's been under a lot of political strain as well, with domestic protests that have been happening, you know, intermittently over the last few years, in particular earlier this year, which were quite significant. You know, it's been under a lot of pressure from Israel and the United States, not just from the economic standpoint, but also from, you know, the standpoint of armed conflict. You know, things didn't just start on February 28th. Things started before even June of 2025 in terms of armed attacks against Iran, you know. And I'm really worried and I'm very scared as to where Iran goes from here. Who knows when this war will end. My hope is that Iran is not brought to its knees. But I remain worried that even if it's not, you know, how do we put the pieces back together, you know, from an economic standpoint, from a political standpoint, from a, you know, security standpoint. You know, the country is going to need to come together, but unfortunately it's quite divided. Maybe this war has helped bring more people together, but I doubt that it has to the extent that needs to happen. But that unity, I think, will be key to any better future for Iran going forward. So I pray that, you know, the country will be able to pull itself up by its bootstraps, so to speak, and rebuild. But not just from a, you know, material standpoint, from a, you know, psychological standpoint as well, and an emotional standpoint. You know, there's a lot of healing that needs to happen in Iran.
So I think we'll leave it on that note. Miriam, as always, we're very grateful for your time. Thank you for coming on the program. And I do wish the best to you and your family getting through this.
Thank you so much, Derek. I appreciate it.
This is the new Weight Watchers, built for real life and real results, no matter what mode you're in. Maddie went all in for her big day and lost 33 pounds. Emily lost 85 pounds and hit her goal while still living her life.
Weight Watchers gave me the tools and I feel amazing.
Join the millions of members and lose weight with the number one doctor-recommended weight loss program. Lose more at WeightWatchers.com.
At 6 months, participants in a clinical trial of Weight Watchers program lost an average of 12 pounds.